Welcome to Ever Beyond. On Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and Tir na Sao in Ireland. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. Good afternoon. No, stop. Stop. Little player. Sorry, I'm holding the station together with sellotape and or sticky tape and string this afternoon, mainly because I'm halfway through installing the new KX Studio Linux, and I've not finished yet. And by the time I get to my next shift, if I can get some studio downtime, I'll be able to swap the machines in and out and have a new Ubuntu Linux broadcaster. Nobody knows exactly what I just said, apart from some. About three people perhaps out of all the listeners. Anyway, but that's the state of play and why I keep on overrunning the tracks and they don't just stop and the voice comes back in like they used to normally do. It will happen when I get the whole thing, set back up. But I've got a lot to fix up before that. Anyway, that's very boring maintenance stuff because I've got a really interesting guest today. We you know, he's been sending me some stuff on Facebook over the last few months, and I thought, right, it's time. Now it is time to speak to Michael Graham. So, really, without very much further ado, because we've not, you know, we're really jazzing. This is jazz radio. We've not spoken apart from chatted. I don't even know what your voice sounds like, just a little bit. So, good afternoon, and where are you speaking from today, Michael?
Hi, JP. I'm good afternoon to you. Actually, it's evening time right now. I'm speaking from New Jersey, in the United States.
New Jersey, indeed. Yeah. Yes, we have our favorite moderator is from New Jersey. Her name is Vanessa, and. She's in the chat room herding the cats who are our listeners. They're all cool cats because this is jazz. It's like, I was at a party the other day and I was, there was musicians playing and there was a beagle and, the beagle was just kind of going, for quite a long time, I've been, playing guitar and listening to the beagles and playing along. And I realized that that's what blues is. Is people talking to their dogs with their guitar.
Yeah, well, blues is sort of like, some people have said blues is like the black man's country.
Mm-hmm.
Losing your dog and your girlfriend and
yeah,
generally being sad and somehow being happy about it.
It's the blues and that's just the way things are. So anyway, we have more spectrums than blue, but, I do like blue myself and where should we start? I mean, you started talking, a long time ago, connecting in with the Andronicus material, which, I have to say, it's 2 hours out of, I can't remember, like 16 hours of broadcast that I do a week. So it's just one thing after another for me. You know, some people go and they listen to one show and they listen to the next episode of that show, but for me it's just like 2 hours out of the week and I'm just onto something else, and then I got Sean's show and then all these other things, and by the time the evening's finished I've kind of forgotten what went on during the show. So much happens, so people are actually listening to the thing on the other side of that, and also, you know, I'm focusing on like, what does this voice sound like, are my levels correct? You know, all these things. So, from your perspective, what was, What was your experience of it? How did you find this strange little thing? I don't even know what to call the Andronicus transmissions. It's the strangest thing.
For me, I haven't followed up on the latest episodes, but I started off being drawn to it because of the mention of Andronicus, well, specifically the Andromeda beings, and eventually got into some material about Apollo, which is one of my favorite characters to research. But it started off as this amazing sort of ad lib thing that you would do, and then it evolved into, I don't say this in a negative sense, but it sounds like an amazing soap opera, like a radio show. And I thought it was pretty enjoyable. I also found some pretty interesting synchronicities about the information that was being brought forth, how some of the material that was discussed could be corroborated with some of the mythologies that I've been familiar with. And that's sort of what got me interested in listening a little bit further. But realistically, JP, originally I started listening to you through the Simon Parks material, and a number of other shows. So it goes a little further back than Andronicus.
All right. Excellent. So I was glad you kind of stumbled into the Andronicus world. And again, you know, he's like many things. He's almost like the whole human evolutionary path in some ways. And I call these guys archetypal beings. They exist on a different level to us in terms of our consciousness. It's like thousands of us constitute one of them, or something like that, you know, like a collective being, meta level is what I'm trying to say, I think. And yet they have a personality and a character. That's what's fascinating.
They do. It's very, I mean, you know, typical archetypical beings are like that. They represent sort of an abstract aspect of, some would say, divinity. And then we embody as human beings different parts of these archetypes, depending on what path we take. And, you know, I live my life sort of via synchronicity. I get my guides to the agreement, and, you know, you guys sort of show me the way, and I'll, you know, decide whether or not I want to go. And there are a number of synchronicities that led me to the Andronicus material. At the time, like I said, Apollo is one of the archetypes that I follow up on. And in fact, one of the beings that I interact with in my own personal daily life. And I was at a point where I wanted to learn more about, concretely who Apollo was through history and in real life and so on and so forth. And, I was led very quickly to the Andronicus material. And there's a mention of Zeus and Prometheus, and another synchronicity is, I believe, right around the same time, I had just finished watching the movie Prometheus when I first started with Andronicus, which I think was about 2.5 months ago, even though the material is much older than that. So it's a series of synchronistic events that cycled around and led me to it, which gave me the information I needed.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. So, because here's my thing. There's this idea that there were these Egyptian gods, and then there's Sumerian gods, and then there was the Roman gods and the Greek gods, and they all got different names, but they all seem to have, yeah, it's like a bunch of bikers who move from one place to another, really causing havoc. They're big. You know, they're larger than humans, and, you know, they basically go out and take whatever humans that they want, and presumably the humans are very happy to be raped and abused by these, by these archetypal beings. But they have a certain character. So have you got the big table, Michael? You know, I'm waiting for someone to come up with the big table that says, okay, Zeus, right. Zeus is this fellow, this fellow, this fellow, this fellow, blah, 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 blah. And he represents this quality and this zodiacal archetype and this frequency and this color. Has anyone done that?
I don't know if anyone has, in fact, done that. I've
I'm putting out for it. Anybody's got one, please send it to me. Thank you very much.
I would love to get it also because I've been on the seeker's path for a long time. Started off with early Christianity, as many people in the Western Hemisphere have, and got out of that and started looking at Egyptian, Greco-Roman, you know, African, Chinese, all these different Hindu philosophies and traditions. And I've started to notice certain patterns that exist between the different silos of religion. There is, if you're familiar with the African Yoruba tradition, which interestingly enough has a very strong connection with the Norse mythological story, Snorri Snorrason and his poetic Eddas, and the detailing of, say, Thor and Odin, as it's connected to Obatala of Yoruba tradition, and Shango, who is the double headed axe wielding thunder god, which is similar to the double headed half-wielding god of Thor.
All right. So Michael, it's just the accenting of it. So I would call them the Yoruba. Are you talking about the Yoruba of Nigeria?
Correct.
Aha. Yes. You know, I had no idea. I used to have a Yoruba girlfriend. Well, usually girlfriend, but female friend. They were just running away from Biafra at the time, and it was like not much time to take their tradition. So that's fascinating that they had a Norse god type tradition, or at least they're talking about the same characters, but with different names. Yeah.
Indeed. Exactly. And so I came to realize after time that, you know, these gods, they live many thousands or millions of years, and they've been interacting with us for a long, long time. And as you go from culture to culture, as you say, biker gang style, these different cultures interact with these gods in different ways and give them different names. And, you know, they may focus on one particular aspect of them, as opposed to another. And so you find that there are certain sets of gods, deities that are very similar across the board. You know, Egyptian, Roman, Greek, even the Hindu pantheon has certain gods that are connected. I mean, for example, I like to look at, obviously, again, Apollo, who was both Osiris reincarnated as Horus, and then, you know, became Apollo Apollyon in the Greek and the Roman tradition. And there's an African Aplu who's very similar. And if you go even into the Hindu tradition, you start talking about Apollo as one of the distinct aspects of the god there known as Shiva. He has many aspects, and one of them is a Rudra, and, you know, or specifically Rudra, and the characteristics are uncanny. In fact, there are many comparisons between the two.
Okay, so let's just pause there, right? So there's factor number one, the O person, right? Now, in Andronicus, he's known as Rodan, right?
Right.
Now, whether that's his original name or that's the name that he goes by, but that's the name that he's known as. So he's still got the O sound of Apollo, Horus, Odin, help me out here. Who's the others?
Wodan, or, you know, Rudra could also be Rodra.
Yeah, Rudra is close to Rodan, you know?
Exactly.
And you know, these are very ancient, pronunciations that, you know, do change over time. I mean, you just have to listen to modern Hebrew and Ashkenazi Hebrew, and it's it's a very different sound.
Not familiar with that version, but yeah.
Yeah. So there's Rodan, all right, or Odin, let's focus on his path just for the moment. Again, as I kind of caught onto you, where did Odin go? Where did Rodan go? Where has he manifested in our recent times, or whatever happened to them?
Let me focus on Odin, because really he's the only one I know somewhat about, and I can't say that I'm a scholar. But he got merged. He got absorbed, I believe, into Western Christian models. A lot of the traditions of, even the Odin movement were adopted into Catholicism. I believe there is a tradition that says he, in fact, was born on the 25th of December, So when we celebrate Christmas, we in fact are celebrating Odin's Day. And you know, even in the way we name the days of the week for, you know, English speakers, Wednesday is Woden's Day. So where did he go? He sort of went dormant into the annals of pagan suppression, I suppose. But, you know, he's, again, being a character, he is one of the divinities that interact with us, and he reacts to those who know him by the names Odin, and also some would say, you know, he's similar to Mercury in or Hermes in the Roman or Greek pantheon, and some equate those two with the archangel Raphael. So I don't know. Some would say there, in a stretch, he's evolved and is still active in some aspects as the archangel Raphael in today, which, you know, those guys hang around for a long time. Is one of my, those are my favorite people, the archangels.
Yeah. So, I mean, here we have, we've got the gods and we've got the archangels. And well, they say they were gods. You know,
right.
I'm not always all convinced really. They're just, and all right. So that's, they seem to have been absorbed, as you say, somehow.
Right.
But how do they I mean, yes, they manifest as the energy of Wednesday, right? There's Rodan's Day, you know, which was also, and then that's kind of, there's also, Mercury.
Right.
So does he become Mercury? Do they become planets? Do they merge into planets or something like that?
Well, I mean, you know, kind of given the name Mercury, because of the characteristic of him being the messenger of the god and the planet, I suppose, being the closest to the sun, which in those days when they were naming these things, was the sun represented God. Mercury was the first hand of the guy who would go and come. So I wouldn't say that he became the planet Mercury, and I don't believe that he even is the consciousness of Mercury. But you know, but in terms of how he interacts with us on an archetypical level, you know, some would say he's a god of war and wisdom. He also travels frequently in the underworld. You know, in what way do we incorporate that into different belief systems? And because again, these archetypes that filter down through not just the human species, but there are other extraterrestrial and extra-dimensional species that are subject to some of these archetypes, right? These are universal principles as far as I can tell. And different beings play certain roles, you know, who was Anubis, you know, in the Egyptian tradition. And there's a reason I mentioned Anubis, because he was the one who would go back and forth between the underworld and was, you know, the guardian of Isis, which is the archetypical Mary. And Mary in New Age tradition, her counterpart is Raphael. There is even a merger of Anubis and Hermes in some of the literatures. They call him Hermanubis because they're very similar. So where did they go? They kind of went everywhere. They're pervasive. You know, that's how I've observed it. They show up, in ways that, you know, we may not immediately recognize, but I don't know because, you know, it's really us, the human species, in our lost state of bewildered forgetfulness that we're trying to grasp onto identity and being able to narrow down, you know, a consciousness to one narrow band where we can identify it. And so I don't believe some of these beings are so intent on, okay, this is me, this is what I do, and only these things. So I guess in a long roundabout way, I think they sort of merge with our reality, and wherever we identify them is where they are. They're kind of everywhere, what I think. That's sort of a wonderful non-answer, but.
All right. Okay. So, let's say they've faded to gray, you know.
Well, I wouldn't say gray. They sort of merged into the grand consciousness of who we interact with, the source and pantheons.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm using sort of cinematic Terminator. Like, it's just blending in.
Right.
But how about where they started? I'm always interested in the beginning. You know, I'm interested in where humanity started, where everything started going wrong for a start, you know, because obviously things are wrong and, things have started going wrong and they started sometime going wrong. So when was that? And is it anything to do with these guys?
Well, I mean,
or are these guys a kind of effect? You know, humanity's like, and these guys come along saying, oh, look, hello, little humans. and they go, oh, we're looking for our gods. Are you our gods? And they go, yeah, sure.
I actually think that is sometimes what happens. Again, they're archetypical. So some more powerful beings than us and, you know, higher dimension or whatever may come in and they may embody, whether deliberately or opportunistically, some of these archetypes. And they're like, yes, we are the gods, such and such and such and such, and you will obey us and do what we ask you. And, you know, when you think of that particular god, this is who you should envision. And they are not necessarily that god. You know, they're, in the old days, there's a tradition that says Osiris himself was not, or Osiris, the Egyptian god, he was not a god. He was simply a very powerful pharaoh who, in the tradition of Egyptian and African deification of the ancestors, he became a god after death. Now, who was the man who some would say became Osiris? And was he Osiris before the archetype, or did he embody the archetype? And same thing with Horus. So then there was a man who was Horus. There was a man who was David, who, you know, in many ways, there's a lot of connection between the Celtic god Lu and the Jewish Hebrew David. Very, very similar. But are they embodying, and are they the beginning, or are they representing a holographic manifestation of a principle? And, you know, if you talk about holographic representations, you talk about the Christ lineage, which again is one of my passions, right? You talk about beings like Horus, Tammuz, you know, Jesus, obviously. There are many similarities in these stories, but is it solely because the great quote unquote evil Catholic Church munched all these different traditions together? Or is it that the holographic replay happens in these characters' lives over and over and over again? I want to make reference to some of David Wilcock's material, where he discovered somebody else found patterns repeating themselves over and over and over again in the Bible. I think it's psychology was the term he mentioned, where things happen in a cycle. As we evolve and ascend, we go in a spiral, not in a straight line or a zigzag, but, you know, things will happen over and over in everybody's lives. I mean, even in my own life, there are certain patterns that are happening that are, you know, some would look on it and go, wow, you know, there's a distinct Christ pattern there. So where do they start? That's, you know, sometimes they start with a man who becomes a demigod, who then plays a certain role, and that gets added to the overall mythology of some of these characters. That's what I think. Are we there? Hello?
I'm terribly sorry. I just had to go and stoke the stove because I have a wood burning stove. And I was just making a whole load of noise going, and then it was all quiet. And I thought, oh, he's finished his point. Just a little bit too early. Anyway, so your feeling is that they're men who became gods?
In some cases, I believe that, there are some men who were deified, Asian traditions also deify their ancestors. I believe some of these archetypes were embodied by some men who were either greater than men or who were just powerful men who became deities, who then influenced other traditions. And then I also believe that there are some demigods who actually came to Earth and played a certain role. I mean, some of the pharaohs who are both ancestors and demigods, as you know, being the lineage of both Atlantean and extraterrestrial, some of these pharaohs, and even those who ascended through their Christing technology, could effectively be considered demigod as well as human. You know, so I think that multiple characters played the same archetype throughout history. That's what I think. And each one contributed their piece to the story.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, because there's lots of different stories and they have lots of similarities. And like you say, you know, I'd never heard of the Yoruba story. But you know, I was aware of the Yoruba tribe. Is it King Sunny Ade is Yoruba? Anyway.
I don't know.
I'm sure. Anyway, so, yeah, I love African music, by the way, you know, and reggae, and I'm always playing, playing our poor listeners, Jah Shaka dub and stuff like that. That's my favorite kind of stuff. Anyhow, you know, I love the sound system and I love to stick my head in a bass bin. Well, I used to. Please.
Well, I mean, personally, you know, my overall drive when it comes to these things, is a realization that we are, even though we're made of, you know, these 12 strands of DNA on a human, you know, human species, we are really one collectively, one people. And I think sometimes the focus and the mistake we make, on a granular level is to focus on what's different and how mine is better than yours. You know, there is, there's more in common than we have in separation. And if you look at, when you take away the characters, you know, you take away some of the mythologies and some of the human projected assumptions onto some of these archetypes, you find that the message is sort of universal, you know, and throughout the different movements, you know, there's love your brother as you love yourself and focus on finding your reconnection with divinity. And I mean, that's sort of a very, very rough,
okay. Get you. I hear you right now. and again, my audience are probably bored by this by now, but I'm going to go back to it because it's all about where it all came from. And I have this thing that I call the Lyran trauma. And you know, it's something that we were chatting about. And it's, for me, it seems to be the same symptoms as what you're talking about. You know, where humans are easily triggered into distress of separation or even the threat of it. You know, the idea of breaking up your family, of losing your loved ones or your pets is something incredibly distressing.
Indeed. And in part, we were designed to be that way.
Well, now here's the thing. Now, I believe not that we were designed, is that it's an ancient trauma that has been taken advantage of so much in ancient times, it's almost like it's human nature. This is my take on it. So, you know, feel about it however you will, but you know.
I agree. But then what does it mean to be human? As a human species in this world, Terra, you know, on Earth, we are a combination of multiple characteristics. You know, and yes, that age old trauma has imprinted on us, and that old star message, that old star history of the Adam and Eve and the great battle in heaven and the, you know, that's replicated down even into our own Eden, holographic representation is a part of our, even the scientists have determined that there's a way to pass on trauma genetically through your epigenetics. So yeah, what do we carry as, you know, as a species? Yeah,
exactly.
Right. So I believe the Lyran trauma has definitely played a significant role in how we interact with the rest of the world. And I, you're also correct, I think, in that this has been taken advantage of. But in addition to that, I believe it's exacerbated by the integration of the reptilian brain and the reptilian genes into who we are. You know, the fight or flight mechanism is very much a reptilian characteristic, even of the human brain, one that gets triggered.
Oh, yeah.
Now, is it that we're so powerfully controlled by the fight or flight? Is it by some nefarious design to keep us, as you say, easily triggered or distracted? Or is it on a higher level, because there's always higher principles that apply, is it on a higher level an attempt to reconcile the two, to be able to use the mammalian compassion and clear thought and forethought to overcome and not necessarily defeat, but to subdue this tendency to go with the fight or flight or the nasty homicidal rage. I believe there was some show, I think it was you who mentioned that, you know, reptilians are very easily triggered into fear because they're constantly in fear of losing their sustenance. Mm. Right. Threaten a person with the loss of, as you said, family, support, supplies, and what happens? They don't go into sort of a blissful state of manifestation. Typically, unless you're enlightened, you go into a state of panic and you want to rip apart your adversary. So what are we called to do? If we continue to have this internal battle, which is reflected externally, even in the sun, according to Abel Casey, what do we do with this battle? What if we can't rip the brain out and take out the reptilian part?
No.
You know, we cannot be human. So I believe that personally, I think the path is the path of this, they say the middle pillar, right? The way of loving transformation into sort of a Christ consciousness. And I don't mean that in strictly a Christian sense. I mean that in the universal sense of awakening into our oneness as a people, as a species, as a universal entity. Yeah. And that's the struggle.
Well, okay. So from my rather basic animalistic side, right, it feels like we have turned each other into mincemeat for the past billion years, ground each other into powder, vaporized, and now we're one big hamburger, right? We're a mixture of Lyran and reptilian, because the reptilians started out eating us, and we have now consumed them. We eat chickens. They taste like chicken. Anyhow, but the thing is, we are a blend now of reptilian and human and higher human and all of this thing. So what they call human nature is not really human nature. And perhaps we need to start really kind of being focused about it. I mean, it's part, yes, okay, so now it is part of our being, but it's not our nature, it's like our burden. What do you think?
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. I think our human nature, as, you know, Simon Parks keeps saying, is one of innocence, bordering on naivete, but mostly innocence.
Yeah.
And as we've experienced life in these many thousands of years, at least in this planet, it's been messed around with by, you know, nefarious characters who take advantage of our nature, who know how it works, and decide to trigger it in many ways to make us become something that we, if left unbidden, would not be. You know, if you take, you know about these horrible mind control things that they do to children. But,
Well, I mean, the last 2 hours have been about that. The previous show was about an MK survivor.
Well, there you go.
We're there, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So the question is, having come out of the MK or the Monarch or whatever the different programs are, is it the nature of the person to be the way they are, or is it the result of corruption? I think as a species, we've been corrupted, and we're being asked to move beyond where we are, having been corrupted, because I think it's our destiny to not go the path of the warrior of we're going to destroy our enemy. That's been done by, I think, another species who we've integrated, right? Now we're being asked to integrate all these different characteristics. We're not, you know, to move into reconciliation and universal oneness, right? Because the fight begets a fight, you know, the
absolutely.
Karma.
You can't stop fighting. You just can't stop fighting by fighting it.
Precisely.
You know, and here's the thing. You know, there's another thing that people call disease. And I believe disease is when the fight goes internal.
Exactly.
And we deny one part of ourselves. And, you know, in healing, I do some counseling and healing work. And one of the things it's really about is being heard. It's when these little parts of ourselves that have never been heard get heard, then everybody's all right. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's giving a voice or acknowledging certain parts of ourselves that we would rather not. There's a similar technique in the shamanic world called soul retrieval. And, you know, when a consciousness is traumatized so severely, sometimes we can break into parts. And some say our soul. I believe it's just, you know, our consciousness shatters and some parts run off and go hide. And in order to bring about reconstitution of a whole consciousness, people have to go and fetch these parts. And a part of the healing process is to hear, to sit and talk to this part and say, hey, what's your trauma? Why are you here? And offer, you know, reassurance that it's not going to happen again. But a large part of healing is acknowledgement. Even, you know, if I were to stretch this just a little bit to go further and to say, even with some of the past life regression stuff, Dolores Cannon does it. There's another man. A number of people do it. Wheel does it. And what simply they do is to bring the consciousness to the moment of the event of trauma. And simply by observing the trauma or even acknowledging that, yes, I was traumatized in this way without any other intention or any other kind of effective therapy, simply by observing this trauma in a past life, the patient, the client, the person is often miraculously healed for good, you know. So, you know, I guess I'm just saying I agree in a long-winded way.
Yeah. So the question is, it's happened to billions of people over billions of years or over a billion years. So how or what is the path to heal it in your, you know, for instance, in your clientele, have you come across anybody who's experienced a trauma this far back in time?
No, I've had clients that, experienced trauma on multiple levels. But not this far back. Now, if I were to be so bold as to suggest, I think one of the ways, as to answer your question, to move toward healing is first the truth. You know, as you know, we're also going through that time when the truthsayers are coming out and things are being leaked left, right, and center in the media that, you know, even a few years ago would have been unheard of. We must first acknowledge what is reality. And then, only then can we know what to do. But, you know, again, if you apply hermetic principles, you know, as above, so below, they're multi-layers of holographic representation of things. First, we have to reconcile the war within. And once we reconcile the war within, then things externally can either easily be fixed or will fix themselves. I mean, for example, you know, a lot of people here on the planet eat animals. We herd them, we capture them, we pen them in, we subject them to horrible torture here in the sort of the American animal factory system. I don't know about the rest of the world, but I've chosen to be vegetarian. Now, if we ourselves as human beings eat animals who, you know, are subject to horrible experiences over and over and over again, how do we, in the face of that, petition any greater being and say, hey, we don't want to be eaten or tortured or abused or penned or treated like property when we ourselves do that? So first.
That, there we are. Okay, many apologies. I don't know when that happened. God, you know, it keeps going on and it keeps going off and I don't know why. And this system is going to be replaced in just about two or three days once I get back online, once I get some downtime. I'm sorry about that. So, I mean, Michael, please go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that one of the things that I do, believe it or not, I work a lot with the angels and the archangels. One of the things that I do in my practice is to remove negative entities from both people and sometimes devices, mm-hmm. Perhaps. JP, you should consider doing something for your machinery.
The djinn. You know, in India, when they first started seeing steam engines, and the magic of these things, they said that there was a djinn inside, and they would point it and say, engine, engine. And, and we now call them engines.
Yes, very interesting.
And the, and well, the, and the engineer was the person, the ghost whisperer, the djinn whisperer.
Yeah, it's amazing how things in history affect every day and we don't even realize. But I, you know, again, you're very familiar with the archonic infestation and how they interact with, electronics. And then there is, you know, there's an associate of mine. I wouldn't call him a friend. I've spoken to him a few times. We hung out a couple of times. A man named Duncan Cameron, who, was a part of the Montauk stuff.
And oh, really? Talks, yeah,
he talks at length about, certain reptilian type, hybridized beings that are responsible for the maintenance and the buffering of the third dimension. And sometimes they get corrupted and they infest machines and cause all kinds of havoc. And I say this, it sounds kind of off the wall woo-woo, but I say this because I've been to a workshop where he discussed this very thing, and he demonstrates this in his workshop, where he has very high quality, high fidelity audio equipment. It's professional studio grade. And he brings it into the workshop, and he demonstrates literally removing some of these little buggers that, you know, they look like little worms, out of the machinery. And he plays the before and after for the audience. And there's definitely a perceptible difference. And it happens. I've seen it happen a couple times where you can literally hear the music a lot better. And I've sat in a room with another person that I'm connected to, who we both, saw the actual entity as it was being removed. And I know she saw it because she gasped at the same time I saw it being removed. So I know some of these things are, you know, they're real and they can get in the way. So, you know, maybe something you want to try for either old and new equipment.
Yes. Well, it is a thought that, you know, I haven't, besmudged or spiritually cleansed. I have a gunter, which I do. There's a Tibetan bell. And it just breaks everything up. It's like, and it's relentless. And you find it gets grindy for a while. You know, it goes, and then it's smooth again. And, that's the demons getting caught and ground up in them. So yeah.
Or it could be just energetic interference.
Yeah. Blood. Yeah. Well, whatever you want to call them. But yes, I mean, even in computer programming language, there is a thing called a daemon, which is an unattended process.
Yes.
So you could say things that just sustain themselves elementally are, that's what a daemon is. It's an unattended process. Anyhow. So, right now, just going to make sure that I'm still online because there's all these things that are, I'm having to completely be on the ball today, which is a bit strange. the station, like, I lose the complete internet for 15 minutes this afternoon for some bizarre reason. It just stops and then comes back. So I don't know. Maybe there are things that they don't want us to speak about. Oh, wow. We'd love to have Duncan Cameron on the show, by the way.
Oh yeah, I haven't been in touch with him in such a long time. Next time when I get a chance, I'll reach out to him. I think you guys would actually get along quite well. He's quite a character. He sounds like he's from the 40s, you know. There's a story, and I'm not sure if it's him. I don't want to actually say it, but I gotta double check this. But I think he might have been one of the guys who came forward in time, you know. And that's why they grabbed him and used him on the chair. He went to Mars, did all kinds of amazing things. Interesting fellow, but he doesn't work well with electronics. He causes all kinds of crazy things to happen. So he's you know. We'll see.
Okay. well, we're using an EMF protector called Shungite. I don't know if you've heard of this stuff.
Yeah, I've been wanting to get some Shungite for some time.
Oh, contact Nancy at cosmicreality.net. She'll send you a bag and some stuff.
All right. Sure.
So, yeah, well, I'll send you her address. She's one of the hosts here. And, yeah, so badass gods all the way down to the trauma. So yeah, so this is one of my kind of pet subjects. And I'd really like to be able to include as many people as possible, and make this kind of like an open source therapy. You know, that nobody's got an expertise in it. It's just something we all know. Like midwifery. You know, you don't get like competitions for the best midwife, do you? They just do.
No.
They just know what they know. They do what they do. And it's a kind of, it's a natural thing. And I think that, we need a vast number of people who are able to perform a process of, to me, it's like almost like combing hair, you know, combing the knots out of tangled hair.
Right.
And perhaps, you know, like bringing the kids in from the wilderness and, scrubbing them up and, having a bath and a shower and cleaning them up for the first time is, a lot of humans are kind of emotionally like that. Having gone through trauma after trauma after trauma.
Well, there's the trauma of the past and then there's trauma of ignorance. There's, you know, we really, you know, there's coming a time when, as you know, a lot of people have been saying, the truth will be known and a lot of people are going to go into shock and we're going to need people to triage and say, okay, here's what we know and here's the reality and have a seat there and, you know, have a sip of this sherry while we give you the true history. And then we're going to have to sort of transition them into, what they thought was reality into the actual reality. I think that we do need to have sort of a program where, we can affect healing without competitive, I'm better than you, ego.
Absolutely, absolutely. It just can't happen. we have to have real healers who are really healing and being humble about it and just kind of one after the other. That's it. That's it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And it's, there's a mission in there that is karmic as well. So, there are things that we learned how to be warriors and we've now learned how to be healers too.
Right.
And it's time to heal everything. And that includes healing the reptilian side.
Exactly.
You know, and here's the thing is that people have this thing, oh, we must destroy the ego. We must, no. And as you were saying before, Saint Michael stands on the dragon. He doesn't kill it.
Exactly. He subdues it because the dragon is a part of our universal heritage. The dragon is the energy of creation and manifestation. You know? So the consciousness that brings things about is the dragon energy. You don't kill it. You subject it to a higher authority, which is what Michael represents, Archangel Michael represents, the will of God. That's, you know, what his mandate is. And, you know, you talk about healing as karma or the karma of healing precisely. In true, some of warrior castes, the masters not only learn how to be warriors, but they also learn how to be healers. You know, I'm a Kung Fu practitioner and I've studied Qigong as well. And I think, you know, you talk about yin and yang, you can't, it's imbalanced to have one without the other. It's also irresponsible. If you're given the knowledge how to destroy somebody, then you should also, or at least not destroy them, you know, sort of severely damage them. You should, I believe, be given the knowledge of how to mitigate some of that damage. And to that end, I have, you know, I'm a part of several groups, but a part of my mandate, given to me by my Hindu Swami teacher. He doesn't like to call himself a guru. He calls himself a teacher and a friend, which makes him unique amongst many. But one of the mandates, and even it being my dharma before I met him, is to effect healing. To bring about healing in as many ways as possible to as many people. And to that end, he was able to restore many, many ancient, really ancient, Hindu, manuscripts. They call the palm leaf scrolls that were so secret that, you know, many people knew nothing about even the people who were guarding them. This man incarnated, his name is Sri Kaleshwar. He incarnated in South India and masters would come out of the woodwork and present him with these different manuscripts that had ancient healing techniques. His mandate was to teach these techniques because, you know, this is going to sound a little interesting, but he was a contemporary of Christ, of Jesus, in the time of Jesus. And so one of the agreements he made, one of the commitments he made to Jesus was in this time to come back and to spread the teaching of how to heal. And how to become the new Christ generation, or the new wave of healers that would go and help to transition humanity into this new consciousness where they're aware of how they've been traumatized and work to heal that. So yeah, it's part of my dharma.
Indeed, where karma becomes dharma.
Uh-huh.
Where guru becomes G, you're you. So, I don't know if you were hearing the beginning, but my show, because it's like we're going beyond gurus and all this stuff, because we have to become, you know, as the war is within, the spiritual path is within. You know, you could go to the Himalayas, you could, you know, study all these things, you could go to India, you could go all these different pilgrimage. Good idea, you know, doing pilgrimage, because that connects you with the land where you were when you last incarnated there. And so you got your, you know, sort of restoration package, kind of thing. But it's best to kind of get to the vibration of who you are.
Exactly. I believe wholeheartedly in that. And again, this is why I like this particular teacher, because he's not all about the bow at my feet and give me roses. In fact, when they would give him these reeds, he would take them off and pass them on to other people. He was more interested in teaching healing principles so that we would go out instead of staying in the Himalayas, so to speak, or in India. You would go out into the world and bring healing, not necessarily to spread a message, but simply heal the sick, you know, feed the hungry, clothe the poor, you know, in the tradition of Shirdi Sai Baba, which is a lot of what he did. And again, this is one of my teachers. He's not the only one, but his message and his technique integrates very well with me. And I feel like there's a karmic dharmic relationship. But yeah, I believe it's time to move beyond at least the traditional guru, where you would sit at one person's feet in total devotion to their every word. There was a time when that was necessary, but I don't believe we're there now. We have graduated, I think, to a higher level of consciousness. Oh, yeah.
You have to realize that that's, you know, the external that's just the beginning when you see somebody else as potentially spiritual, but it's when you see your own spirit and express it yourself. And it's really simple, because that's what kids do all the time. You know, this is really hard not to. You know, and as we're beaten and traumatized into adulthood, we lose it all. You know, by the time we're 10, then we've forgotten how to be spontaneous and happy and all that stuff. And the world is very serious, and there's taxes and school and, buses and violence and guns and terrorists and ISIS and, you know, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And so there comes a point when somebody's got to say, yeah, stop. Stop! I want to get out of this kind of spinning, spiraling madness.
We're force-fed the scarcity model, which is one of the ways we're controlled as a society.
So that's a reptilian thing, right?
Yes,
isn't it? That's one of the. You see, what I'm working on. So here's where our work kind of blends here. What I'm coming to the idea is that there are all these different human races, or all these different races that make up the human.
Mm-hmm.
These, the you know, different, whatever they call 12 strands of DNA, or the different races. But each one of them has their trauma. And that we suffer them all, which is why, you know, the burden of humanity is to carry all of these traumas and to heal them. Perhaps by bringing together these different threads within us, by relating, having relationships with people who are Anubian or Arcturian or this or thatian. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, each piece, it carries a part of the whole puzzle. Just like, you know, you've got, like, quickly make a reference to the Book of Q, where, you know, the Synoptic Gospels all took pieces of that one puzzle, but there's one doctrine that holds the key. Just as, and you know, with you saying that these races that make up who we are each have their own trauma, but you know, in the words of one of my teachers, Max Christensen, who created the Kunlun system, is a Taoist, amazing superhuman guy with the rainbow body stuff. He also says each of these races have their own gift, And, you know, for some may be able to have the gift of teleportation. The others have the gift of material, manipulation. And we have all of these things. Along with the trauma, we have all the gifts combined into one being, one person. And I think this is part of the reason reptilians are so key to grab our DNA and trade it and keep us locked down so we don't manifest all these sort of avatar, quote unquote, powers to become such great beings. But if we can leverage the gifts of each of these races to help heal the trauma and then heal each other, then where do we go from there?
This is the point. Yes, exactly. This is exactly the point. This is how we evolve through into those things. And it's through, all right. So here's my idea, or, you know, why I understand, like, you kind of fall into these things, you know, something happens during a session and you note that, oh wow, that really worked better than the other way. So you've refined your method, or that's how I've been working anyway. And so it's getting to the point now, where when you basically you reconnect with the broken feeling. You see, we have a broken feeling within us that is we're unable to feel properly because part of us is stuck outside of our body trying to feel it, but we prevent ourselves from feeling it by doing this kind of we clench a little fist inside us or go right. And it's a kind of, I call it hypoxia, the you know, having not enough brain not enough oxygen. Yeah, this is the having not enough oxygen in the brain.
Right.
Exactly.
There's a sphincter clenching that happens. Too,
exactly. Right? Different sphincters hold different traumas. Yeah. Now, when you get to the release of those things, that's when you discover your superpowers and sensitivities as well. Because sometimes you have a power of being able to express, but there's also a kind of receiving power as well that corresponds to it, like a radio transmitter and receiver, or a telepathic indeed, to be able to receive telepathy and to be able to send it. You know, those are all certain stages of our development that we often get traumatized at, and sometimes even ritually traumatized.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, it's all well and good. People are traumatized in multiple lifetimes. They carry the marks of these trauma forward. And so it tends to influence behaviors, as Simon Parks often refers to the person with the button trauma. But one must not also forget and ignore that there is a concerted effort to broadcast on a wide spectrum and in certain places more than others. Certain electromagnetic frequencies specifically designed to keep us at a low level of anxiety. So while we're working internally, you know, just like you've got your, you said you have a generator there that negates negative energy, we also have to be mindful of and not be overcome with paranoia, but also be mindful that there is a reality where forces are aligned against healing. And so it's hard to open up and release, as you say, the clenching when upon doing that, you're just going to be bombarded by these negative waves and even entities and so on. So one needs to have a powerful sense of spiritual health where you cleanse, clear, and protect, and be realistic about the fact that there are things to protect yourself from, because there are those who believe in love and light and there's no negativity, but you know that defeats the whole purpose of duality, which is how the world was made, right? So protect, cleanse, clear, and then you can open up to, I think, greater, deeper healing. Maybe
great.
Far as a ritual.
So, Michael, we're at the top of the hour, or just a bit beyond. So let's take a little break so that people can go and use the bathroom, as you say in America, and I'll go and put some logs in the fire and keep the house warm. Because it's summer in Scotland, you know, we only use half the amount of logs. That's all.
Okay.
Anyway, so this is a track. I'm playing the string part of this. There's someone playing a violin, and I'm playing the string part. This is called Sea Forms, and it's Leela Senior who's playing the violin, and Neil.
Your music.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm playing it myself. Anyway, there you go. This is called Sea Forms.
Awesome.
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. Yes, you are. Here we are, back again. So that was Leela Senior and myself. And Neil Sharp just jamming it. When I asked her later, I was following you. What were you playing? She said, I was following you. What were you playing? And that's how it happened. That's how all brilliant stuff happens. It's just that's what I mean by spontaneous reality there. So my guest this afternoon is Michael Graham. And we've been having a very wide-ranging, deep and profound, highly connected, to observers on the path kind of conversation. How's your dharma, my friend?
My dharma is well and progressing. I love the music. That was amazing. I have a special place in my heart for strings and Celtic music in general, especially high mountain Celtic music. Part of my lineage even, but yeah, that was beautiful.
All right. Well, I mean, Leela really, she is very Scottish and she's brilliant. She does all the Scottish traditional violin. She teaches it, but also composes music for films and has studied the Eastern traditions as well. So she blends the Eastern, the Middle Eastern and all of that stuff. And you can hear all those little twiddles in there.
I heard them
from all over the world. They just kind of all fell together. It was just lovely. So, how do we get back? How do we draw it all back? Let's take the journey home. Now we know what the truth is. The truth is that we've been shattered, and in return we shattered that which shattered us. And it's continued, and we've continued shattering ourselves until we're completely fragmented. And as I say, we're hamburger. We're, a blend of all these races who have been at war with each other. It's a horrible thing to think, but we're all in this blend together. Now we are. And, we've all been put in the big vat and saying, figure it out and just don't bother us until you have. What do you think?
Like I said, I work a lot with angels. There was a time when human beings would walk with the angel and with perfect connection with our higher selves, and we would know, as you say, how to figure it out right away, or we would be told, okay, you're not paying attention here. This is what, is actually happening. Here are some options that you might want to consider. Which one would you choose? We have gone through several layers of de-evolution where we've lost a lot of the, and some say that's because the genes have been a lot of the strands have been broken out down to just the two. The guidance comes in subconsciously. But I believe one of the things we need to do is open up and ask for guidance. The angelic realms, at least, they work according to the law of free will, and they will not intervene unless we ask them, which is sort of distinctly different from the negative. They sort of jump in and do whatever they want, whenever they want. But we must first become conscious of the fact that we can't do it alone. We're not meant to do it alone. We must ask for help whenever we feel like we need help. And there can be guidance given to help us to make the right choices. I think that's where it all starts. Where I am now came about because I stopped looking at what I was looking at, and I said, I need help. I need guidance. There was a time I was really going down one particular path, and I said, I don't like this. I want to go somewhere else. And then I was led into it. I mean, this is a story I'm sure a lot of people talk about. I was in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I walked into a bookstore, felt inspired. I walked past several aisles. I walked straight up to this one aisle with this one blue book that was glowing, this ethereal glow of knowing. And I picked the book up, and the book said Interview with an Angel. And that was an amazing book that really opened me up to a lot of things. And, it catapulted me in a whole, I wouldn't say a whole new direction, but it acted like a catalyst. So, and things come to you that way. When it comes, jump on it, follow it, and ask for more. That's what I think an important part of getting us back to where we need to be is.
So to that end, have you found your work, like I say, is it deepening in some way? Have you this, you know, one of the things, here's a thing. I read a book out, you know, in four people, called Atlantis, the Dark Continent. And it started out as a hypnotist who was like deprogramming people from tobacco smoking and stuff like that. And then he started regressing them. And then they started telling these stories, and then they started saying, yeah, but I remember you. And he's like, oh, right. Oh, I'm part of this. All right. And so, and he discovered that he, turned out to be, some really great kind of Machiavellian, brain manipulating crystal, you know, crystal manipulator. And so his karma was to be the hypnotist who, helps them deal with all the trauma. That they put each other through, that he put them through as well.
Okay.
So, and this is why, you know, this is what I'm saying, you know, that we've learned how to kill. We've shown the reptilians how to do it properly. You know, anything that they could do, you know, basically, you know, my feeling is that, you know, the reptilians didn't know who they took on. They thought we were just some, you know, docile sheep type people, but we're not, you know, we'll just rise to any occasion, anything, and we'll just master it. That's, you know, that's why they call us the masters. Cause there is a, you know, a certain percentage of people who are going to survive any onslaught, and they'll have mastered it and stayed on top of the whole thing.
Right. We're the geniuses when it comes to surviving adversity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
So. Because we evolve out of it. We evolve out of the problem. And that's the clever bit. And it happens through the action of spontaneous love. There's always some factor of love that has something to do with the evolving on somehow.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, love is a universal force that brings things into coherence, into harmony, into rightedness, one might say. And some of the spontaneous jumps that we make in evolution are as a result of divine beings who, having evolved from where we are, reached a hand back and said, let me help you come up. And they come as avatars, and many avatars of Vishnu, as, you know, Buddha, the Siddhartha, Gautama Buddha, and Jesus himself, or Yeshua, depending on what you want to call him. And every now and then, as according to the Hindu philosophy, every yuga, there is an avatar that comes to help lead mankind towards the path of salvation. And that's sort of the bodhisattva vow, where a lot of us, even incarnated now, have taken this bodhisattva vow that we are meant to stick around until the human being can realize their greater nature of universal love and wisdom, which is sort of the dual nature of divinity. And with that, achieve healing and transcend this, what is this, you know, the wheel of samsara, this karmic cycle of rebirth, and move on to greatness. You know, I think, a part of who, you know, we're all one big consciousness separated, you know, like fingers on a hand, but we're all attached to the same body, and we're meant to overcome, you know, every challenge that's thrown at us. We figure out a way to integrate, overcome, and expand. And so I think there's the hard way to do it, and then there's the way that's documented and proven, and where it says, here, this is the best way to do it. And universally, over and over and over again throughout history, it's been said the same thing. As you say, love. Love is the way. Love is the way. And it's not just, ooh, I love you because you've got, you know, great legs and your eyes are blue, but beyond just yeah, it goes beyond what we know as carnal or even limited dependent love. It goes into universal, unconditional love. Like the radical concept of loving the reptilian into submission is something that might actually work if it's employed properly. I believe, I think Simon Parks even talked about this recently, where I reference him a lot because I think he's pretty cool. You know, somebody asked him a question, well, how much hallucinogenic drugs does a reptilian have to take in order for them to be overcome with love? and what would happen. And, you know, he talks about them sort of coming to a standstill and living in shock. And I think that's, you know, again, we talk about hate begets hate, fear begets fear, you know, war just is perpetual. And even when you conquer your enemy, there's always someone who's going to come back and conquer you. Love begets love. And what do you do when you're overwhelmed with love and then there's people coming to love you? What I mean, envision that world, you know, you give out as much love as you can. And in return, what does the universe do? It sends you even more. That's bliss. That's heaven, wherever you are.
Earth. Yep. Yep. Even, and you manifest that around you.
Precisely.
It's and it gets more and more and more. And, you just have to keep holding it up and then you meet other people and you make sure that they live close to you. You draw them in,
yes.
And you build it up. That's what my sort of plan is anyway.
I mean, you know, when I say love, you love your enemy, you know, it's sort of a Christian tenet, but not just a Christian tenet. There's all the Buddhist tenets, but you know, I don't mean, let them come in and ransack your house and try to hug them. I mean, you know, don't, you love them, but you don't, you know, what you try to do, because the war is within, right? The struggle is internal. Do you let yourself harbor hate and negativity and ill will towards someone because they've done you wrong? No, you're practical. You defend yourself by any means necessary. But at the same time, you don't let this force, this negative force of hate and anger live through you or find expression within you. And I believe it is a force. Just as there's love, the love force, there's the opposite or the lack thereof, which is the hate force or the fear force. Don't let it find a purchase. If you find yourself experiencing hate and negativity, recognize that it's a separate force that's trying to find a channel through you, which, you know, the human beings have well been conditioned to channel hate and anger. Don't let it sit there. Move it out and choose instead only to experience love. Even if this is an enemy, understand where they are. Okay, they made bad choices. They did stupid things. They're a danger to you and your family. So you're going to avoid them. You're going to defeat them. But you're not going to harbor hate and malevolence toward that person because that just taints you. And that, I think, is a transformation that we need to go through. Because once there is no purchase, there is no place for hate or fear to live within us, then it won't exist around us. You know, that's an ideal concept, but it's just me. That's what I think.
Well, you know, on a practical level, the way I've discovered it is that all I have to do is not react. Because reptilian actions always create reaction. You know, they're provocative, you see. And they make you react. By, you know, pressurizing you in, you know, mental, physical or emotional ways. You know, be it intimidation or psychic or whatever. And it's our being able to breathe through that and remain neutral and humorous that is the greatest test. And that's how we love them.
You make a very good point because, you know, the question is, while in your non-reaction, what state are you in? Are you in a
state
of
love? That's love.
Exactly. Well, see, I mean, you know, it's good to say that, but a lot of people may not realize you can choose to be in a state of love, even in your state of non-reaction. Be in love. Stay in that still place, that blissful state of, there's emergency vehicles going. Well, I don't know if you can hear it, but.
Stay in love. Stay in love. Even if there are emergency vehicles passing by, just remain in love.
In that state, different states of samadhi, of bliss and love, which is, you know, one of the differences between the Buddha state and the Bodhisattva state, which is again one of the things that my teacher demanded that we not enter the Buddha states. Because once you get to Buddhahood, you pretty much don't care about anything behind you. You're like, I'm blissed out. I'm totally sitting here in my place of non-attachment. And I don't, you know, I see negative, I see positive. It's all good. But the Bodhisattva sees, well, you know, negative oppresses the positive and reaches back to try to mitigate while still remaining in that loving place. You know, that's just, I think, you know, that's a good place to be while non-reacting or reacting.
Breathing, just breathing, just being.
Yeah. remain still even while in action. In the old days when Shaolin monks used to do their, you know, their kung fu practices when they would move in their different forms as they would perform them or practice, they would actually be chanting, excuse me, in some instances, a particular mantra. Aha, here's the thunder acknowledging
my name. Oh my God. we've definitely, you know, we got a soundtrack tonight. This is really cool. You know, there's Rodan saying hi.
Thor and I get along pretty well. He's like a buddy of mine. An Indra. But so they would actually be chanting a mantra. And sometimes even in the midst of fighting, you know, because these monks, they would have to learn how to fight because they would travel from village to village to bring medicine and food and sometimes money to the people because they're the only ones who would do that. And they would be robbed and attacked and so on. So they learn how to fight. But even in their combat, they would remain in their sense of inner peace. They would be chanting a mantra or reciting a meditative phrase while they're externally moving, but internally they're unmoved, you know. So that's, I think, a great place to be in non-reacting, right? Because that creates a field around you that affects everything around you, heart map or whatever.
Yeah, that was going on in the background there in New Jersey. What's happening in New Jersey? Something's exploded.
Well, the sky opened up and now it's crying on my window. And there is now, what is this, the second fire truck? If this happens, you know, this happens, we're just going to, I can mute.
Oh, wow. Sorry, I can mute from here. That was close. Anyway, let's illustrate exactly what I've been talking about. You know, just keep going through the different potential stimuli that open you into triggering. Now, I came up with a phrase the other night, and I want to roll it out here, all right? Because what we need to be able to be is, here's the new phrase, is the untriggerable empath. How about that?
That's awesome. I like it.
Wouldn't it be cool to be an untriggerable empath, people? You know, just think about that. So this is what we need to be, because people with PTSD are just going to push every trigger button that you've got. And you can't treat anybody with PTSD if you've got any PTSD left, because they'll push every button you got. Because PTSD hates being well. It's because it's that, you know, that reptilian hamburger.
Yeah, well, there you go. The untriggerable empath would probably be best described again. I hate to use, you know, keep beating this one term, but that sounds to me like a bodhisattva, to remain loving and yet undisturbed by what you observe. Or, you know, divine being, a Christed person, archangel.
Well, let's just break down, because bodhisattva, it's just a Sanskrit word. So what does bodhi mean? Must be related to the Buddha nature, yeah?
Yes, related to the Buddha nature.
Yeah, like Buddhery, right? Bodhi is Buddhery, you know? Buddhery, like Buddhish or something, you know, to be like a Buddha. You know, I'm feeling very bodhi today, you know? It's like, okay, and then what about sattva? Do you know what sattva means? And
you know, I did know, and as is often happen in these cases when you're put on the stand, you don't remember.
Well, look, let's. I mean, what the bodhisattva is that I will remain here in this dimension until everybody's got off, until we've rescued everybody, and then we'll jump on the boat just as it's leaving. Right. Kind of thing. That's what the bodhisattva thing is. And, I've often played it on the, this thing called the Chinrezi Puja.
Yep.
Avalokiteshvari. Yeah, yeah. I mean, people call it different things. What did you say? You said?
I probably meant the pronunciation, but it's the Tibetan Kuan Yin.
Yeah. It's spelled Chen Rezig, but I was saying it was Chinrezi or something like that in the people that told me. Anyway, so which is basically, it's a prayer to say, you know, all these people from all this karma, all these lifetimes have all built up this karma, and we're here to help them process. If you can recognize these people, you can bring them onto the next stage. That's the essence of this, of the prayer, and also of the puja. It's a kind of multi-purpose thing, a sort of teaching and a dedication at the same time. And it's, yeah, and essentially it is, I'm going to, you know, stay here until everybody's better. And I think, I don't think it's actually very long before that's going to happen. I mean, in terms of great global terms.
I mean, better is a relative term, right? I mean, once you achieve, a realization of who you are and what you're doing and what we need to heal, then one needs to commence the path of actually healing. And once you've gotten beyond that, there are multiple levels of healing to be done going onward and upward, right? Even those in the fifth dimension have their challenges, and the sixth dimension have their challenges. Until you've escaped the dimensionality of reality, there's always healing. There's always better to become. But yeah, I think, you know, there's a point where they're going to go, okay, we're good. You're on your own. You can do this. We're off to
see you later.
Get hurt, done that.
Who's with us? See you later. Who's with us? All right. But yeah. Sorry, Michael. I cut you off. Say again?
No,
We're just getting the bus out of it. So we've got half an hour left. If anybody's got any questions, you can chat them into the chat room. JP, captain of the ship. Arr, me Jim lad. Actually, it did feel a bit like a ship when I inherited the station from Dave. It felt like a kind of a boat that had been in the dock being built. You know, just like ready to sail, but not actually there yet. So, it still feels like we're building the crew. So, tying it all back together, we're looking for a way to, not only heal trauma, to go beyond that, to recover our superpowers and our super sensitivities. Because probably, here's the thing, every sensitivity has a power. And so if you've cut off the sensitivity, it was the feeling, you can't use the power anymore. And so when you get the feeling back, you can, you know, it's like being able to put your hand through a little glove box that you can do things with, handle radioactive materials and things. So we have all these different attributes. Have you managed to narrow down any of the attributes, these qualities, or superpowers? Well, actually, I suppose the Buddhists have done it since time immemorial, would you say? Are we talking about the same thing? You know, have the Buddhists figured out the whole 12 strand thing and all that stuff?
The Buddhists, the Tibetan and the Chan and the different Buddhist traditions have figured out how to achieve different states of enlightenment, which activate, as you say, superpowers. And so do the Hindu. There's a lot of, especially in my particular lineage, a lot of focus on the Divine Mother and the fact that she is the one who bestows what's called the siddhis to people. You know, there are the yogas that you practice and maintain and nurture over time, which is your own personal power. And then there's the great power, because the mother is a power in the universe, at least one major power. And so she bestows the siddhis onto her devotees according to merit. And, you know, one of the things when doing this work, when awakening and moving into a greater awareness of who we are as a people and the potential, is to not, I believe, not to be too caught up in, as they say, attaining superpowerhood, because the pursuit of power is a fast track to corruption, right? This is sort of what led to the fall of many powerful people. As, you know, again, biblical reference, seek ye first the kingdom of God and all will be given unto you. If you go after a thing for the power of having it, then to me, that's not necessarily the best intention behind.
Oh, no. But what I'm saying is that the benefit of going through the process of releasing your traumas is that you gain A, sensitivity, and B, a greater degree of being able to manipulate the universe.
Absolutely. And, you know, with great power comes great responsibility.
Absolutely. And more responsibility to be a human.
Yes. And so one, you know, yes, when you heal yourself, you reconnect, and your inheritance, your natural state of being, is in fact a powerful person. And you know, one must learn to wield the power and wield it rightly. You know, one of the things that you know, I'm going to try to tie two seemingly different things, but one of the things I've noticed about the technological evolution of humanity as we have it right now is an attempt, I think, on an energetic level, to have power without the spiritual maturity to wield it. Because some of the things that these transhumanist movements and these technological cloning or life extension techniques are aiming at are the very things that we as an enlightened or a species, or we as a even slightly more enlightened, it didn't have to be like a Buddha, but you know, you just have to activate even a little bit more, you can do naturally. But the way they're trying to do it is to do it without the burden of maturing spiritually, which is sort of antithetical to, I think, the way things should happen naturally. You know, if you give a child a machine gun and you don't teach him how to use it, then you have the potential for chaos. So I'm very weary about how, you know, we're more and more able to do these amazing things without the, I'd say, spiritual maturity to know how and when and where to employ it. And so, yeah, healing first, I think, and then as the abilities unlock, for sure, use them, and use them in massive ways that can transform on a divine scale where we are and what we're doing, and be the change that we want to be, or we've been trying to become. Yeah, I think.
Well, I'm just hashtagging here on TalkStream Live. Hashtag transform to divinity. There we go.
Yeah.
So we've got about 20 minutes left. And so, very interesting conversation. It's really good to, like I say, I like to gather perspectives, what people are doing and how they're, it's really how people approach this whole thing. You know, people have been approaching this thing for a long, long time. But a lot of it is in like foreign languages and in Sanskrit and in, you know, ancient Turkish, you know, manuscripts, all that stuff, Babylonian, rune,
yeah.
You know, yeah. There's all this stuff and it's all there. But we haven't got the words for it today. And we need the words for it in order to express what the feeling is. I think it's all about feelings. Okay. And how you move from one state to another is through the feeling. And because feelings transcend time and space. They're instantaneous. And, that's how I get back there, is take people on that journey, is to go back through the feeling. It's interesting.
Yeah, the feeling, you know, you're right. It does transcend even the cloak, the illusion of separation. The feeling is very in tune with the heart, and the heart is that vortex that goes directly to that portal, as I said, that goes directly to the source of divinity, right? And so, you know, the feeling, if we can name the feeling and acknowledge and heal the feeling, and then, you know, according to Greg Braden, when he talks about controlling the feeling, when you combine thought and feeling together, then you create reality, right? This is when you can have a coherence of thought, intention, and feeling, you can create amazing things. So this is one of the key reasons I think we need to heal a trauma. Because, you know, even in our tradition, and I say our tradition, I'm talking about the Hindu tradition that I'm a part of, there is, you know, unless you can clean that pit of manifestation, you're going to create chaos, a tainted outcome, things that are just as traumatized as you are in your own life.
And that's part of the journey as well. you know, you find people who are more traumatized than you, you bring them back a little bit, and then you have to go and figure out, wow, I actually was more traumatized than this, and you find you go deeper and deeper and deeper, and you, it goes, and then you can go back to that same client and take them to the next level, and then you have to, you know, it's like kind of right. climbing up a chimney.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the amazing things, and like I said, in my work, I do, I work with clients in different ways, but one of the amazing things, and I have a number of colleagues who this has happened to, as soon as I myself have reconciled a particular trauma, I realize, oh my God, I'm traumatized in this particular way, or I carry this burden or this wound. And I go through a process and I make a concerted effort to heal myself or at least reduce the effect of the trauma. As soon as I'm done with that, I will find that there are a stream of clients that come that have exactly this problem. That, you know, they call me, they email, they say, I have this problem. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I just got through going through, you know, a process of healing for this type of thing. And so in a way, yeah, I think, you know, heal yourself first, heal or heal thyself, sort of the Chiron wound, right? And then having transcended that limitation, we can offer our own enlightened perspective to more people and bring them to, you know, at least as far as we've gotten, maybe even further with the assistance of divinity. You know, but that's the beautiful part of healing and offering healing, because necessarily you also get to heal yourself.
Yeah. And it's like one of those nice things where, you know, what, instead of it being you suffer and everybody gets better, is
right.
You get better and everybody else gets better. And then because everybody else is better, you get a bit better and then you can bring everybody else up. You know, it keeps turning around that spiral again. As soon as we don't have to keep, and here's the thing. Imagine what the world would be if we didn't have any debts to pay tomorrow. You know, you didn't have to worry about your mortgage because it's, you know, it's all been paid off. You didn't have to worry about any car loans. That car outside is yours. How would that right. feel? What would you feel like if that were the way? And then live that way. Despite
yeah.
the fact that you think you've got debts, because then the debts might transform somehow.
I think a lot of people would live their passion and they would find that their passion fits perfectly into a system where if everyone is living their passion, there is no competition. There is harmony. And then we will find a greater purpose for the collective humanity, or at least the greater purpose for society. When everyone is living, you know, impassioned, aligned with their highest good, then those are the steps that bring forth, you know, heaven on earth. I think, honestly, until you, you know, move on to another passion and another one, and then you transcend. You might even find that beings outside of your own existence are so attracted to the bliss and joy and productivity that they want to contribute to it just for the purpose of living their own passion. How do you contribute to even the galactic destiny? Like, you know, it's a dream. It's a wonderful vision to hold and try to manifest one day at a time, one person at a time, one decision at a time.
I tell you, I really want to play my electric guitar before the Galactic Council. Check out what they do on Earth. Check this thing out.
I want to, Jesus, man, he's going to play bass.
Jesus on bass.
Buddha.
Yeah, Buddha on the drums. Anyway.
Exactly.
Buddha on a stick. So, oh, well, brilliant. I mean, it's a bit, we have to break out of the, of this kind of fake reverence that everybody's, oh, you must speak ill. You know, these are living character entities and they don't, you know, they laugh a lot. These divine beings, they laugh a lot.
GP, get out of my head. I was just about to tell you.
Kevin, tell me.
I was just about to tell you that you talk about the reverence and the fact that we need to, you know, I mean, a lot of the, I'm most versed with Christianity, and so I make reference to it a lot. And a lot of the teachings, through the traditional church is one of been somber oppression and guilt ridden, you know, reverence, as you said. But we are not aware of the fact that, you know, these people were people and they lived human lives. And, you know, one of the things that even conceptually, though I knew this, Jesus was a man or Yeshua was a man. And well, his story is really a collection of several people, but the actual Yeshua that came to do stuff, he was a guy, a dude, I like to say. And he had, you know, human characteristics. And one day I saw an image that, like I said, conceptually it made sense. And I thought I knew it all along, but having seen it, I realized that, wow, it triggered something. And this is the image of the laughing Christ. It's actually a book that was written. I can't remember the name, but there's a book written by a lady called The Laughing Christ or The Laughing Jesus. And just the image of seeing Jesus laughing or Yeshua laughing triggered some and healed a lot of stuff that goes way back. Because, of course, you only see him on the cross. There's a crown of thorns. He's bleeding. It's very sort of, you know, sadistic. But yeah, he laughed, he drank wine, he partied, you know, had kids too, apparently. So I think that makes him much more, approachable, identifiable.
Well, you know, we've been, beaten with sticks for 2000 years to say Jesus wasn't like us, but really, it's just that we, you know, we're like Jesus. They weren't like Jesus, but we're like Jesus. You know, the Romans, they weren't like Jesus. They weren't not at all not like, they were completely not like Jesus, but like everybody else is kind of a lot more like, you know, real native people are really more like Jesus. You know, that, like, and he's just saying, you know, just be, as the Germans say, be a mensch, you know, be a man, be a good man or be a good woman or be, you know, actually, the story is to be harmless, isn't it? Is to, if there's disharmony, to bring harmony. If there's a war, to stop the war, not to start, never start a war.
Right.
And if there's pain, there's healing. You know, you just serve the moment as you go. And these are the Bodhisattva warriors, as you call them, or the warriors of Shambhala, or the, what did I call them? Untriggerable empath.
The archangelic doctrine.
That's right. Yeah. Say that again.
The archangelic doctrine.
The archangelic doctrine. Ah, wow. That sounds like a book. It sounds like several volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Volume one. And it's 14 inches thick. So, Where would you like to take this? I mean, are you looking, do you need more clients? You know, are you looking for more, challenges in your healing? What are you learning for yourself at this moment?
Wow. Constantly learning. There are different, processes that I go through that are meant to, purify my blocks and help me to see more of where some of my back doors are, and you know, I face on a daily basis even my own triggers that I have to apply higher principles to. You know, things get to me, they piss me off, and I have to catch myself being, you know, ignorantly human and try to live the better life and make better choices. In terms of my clientele, you know, I it's basic. I work with angels. I get people to connect with their guides. I walk them through a process of saying, okay, here's the angel that's next to you. This is the archangel that you're connected to. This is a message that they have for you. And here's how you can connect with them on a more profound, direct basis. And yeah, you don't need me. Go off, do your thing, you know, cause I don't necessarily need people to keep coming back over and over again. Like, my goal is to get people to a place where they're able to sort of do it on their own. They'll help as much as possible.
That's what I was waiting for. Exactly. That is exactly the right, to me, that's exactly the right attitude. You're not looking for clients. Like the pharma industry, you're looking right to heal people and like keep moving. You know, there's a lot more people coming your way.
Exactly. And there are people that come back because, yeah, you know, they trust me. We have a relationship and some things require multiple sessions to heal. Like I said, I do negative entity removal. And so sometimes it takes a while. But you know, I tend to, you know, I have a website. I don't advertise it. All of my clients are word of mouth, and you know, if you look on any profile, you won't find me. I depend on the universe to bring me who they need to bring me at exactly the right time. You know, at exactly the right volume. I don't do this full time, even though it is my dharma. I do it mostly outside when I'm not, you know, I haven't got a full time job working in corporate America, but most of my time dedicated to this type of thing outside of that. So do I want to see more clients? Yes, but only if I can help them. I want to see humanity healed. That's what I want to see. I want to see people awakened to the reality of their greater nature, and to whatever extent I can help, I'm glad to do it. Whether through clientele or radio shows or whatever, you know, I would love to see people come together to offer, you know, each person has their own gift, their own speciality. I'd love to see people, a group come together to offer, healing to people, you know, counseling the people. I can do healings. I've studied several healing modalities, and I've got this, you know, thing that I developed on my own, the different types of healing, but I'm not a counselor. I don't necessarily want to be a counselor. So I envision a group where, you know, okay, I've done my part. You go off to, that person there who's really good at counseling because you need some counseling. And then when you're done, you need to learn how to do energy healing. So because you're gifted in that way. So go to that person and we're all in the group. I'd love to see that happen. That's sort of a global vision that I want to, you know.
Yep. Do you know what? I've had a similar religion, because it's a village, right? Or a little micro village, maybe like half a dozen houses, maybe a dozen people or so. And one of the houses is empty. And people can come and they stay there, and each of the different houses, even the different, houses in the cluster is a healing room of some kind, which works on different levels. You know, some may be body healers, you know, do massage and physical therapies and things like that. And others may be more spiritual, alignment or emotional alignment or, you know, different parts. And so basically whatever somebody needs, they can receive from any of these people in the village. And the village is a kind of self-sustaining, eco, you know, it's self-sustaining. It generates its own energy and, lives. Yeah, it's off the grid. It's in a forest. It's half underground. You know, the whole thing. Yeah. Everybody wants to live there. We all want to go there. You know, this is called
pretty much a vision I've had. I even researched several technologies to sustain an off the grid, village to that extent.
Yeah. I think, you know, This is what the, look, have you not figured it out by now? This is the Bodhisattva's way, right? This is what we're here to do. This is what we're doing on the planet. You know, now you see other people doing this. There's a pattern, you know, and we're all being fed by the Buddha, and, you know, we're being led to different discoveries and all of these things. It's marvelous. I think it's a marvelous thing.
Yeah. There are those who are led by Buddha. There are those who are led by Shiva. You know, those who are led by Yeshua and so on. So, but they're all working for the same group. You know, even though here the factions, and even Muhammad, you know, an enlightened being, the factions argue and bicker amongst themselves and commit horrible atrocities because we accept not only the positive aspects of these energies, but we pull in and integrate with the negative aspects. So. Down here, we fight and bicker and try to prove who is better. But up there, they're, you know, in perfect harmony, and they're working all for the same, I believe, for the same purpose in their own way. Like I said, Buddha is on drum, Jesus is on bass, but it's all part of the same band. Right?
That's right. And they make a hell of a racket. Anyway. So this is excellent. So, now. All right. So how would, if people, did, want to, connect with you for some reason, mm-hmm. as perhaps aforementioned, you know, people could, yeah. You know, because people hear different frequencies in different people's voices, which nourish them, you know, so, people, if you've been nourished by Michael's frequencies tonight, I, you know, I'll put you in touch. It's okay. You know, get in touch by Skype and, I'll put you in touch with Michael. Is that all right then? Does that work?
Perfect.
Okay. Yes. I'll just give him your website and it's got a contact form and boom, 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 boom. Yeah. Good.
Yes. Okay. Website is michaelsrighthand.com.
Oh, well, there you go. It's on the show. michaelsrighthand.com.
Right.
There you go. Good, 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 good. So, thank you very much, Michael Graham. It's been a very interesting conversation. You know, as I said, it's jazz. We start off with something familiar. We come back to something familiar. As a kind of outgoing message, what would you, you know, you've got, you know, about 3 or 4 minutes. Would you like to fill that time with whatever you want, whatever you want, whatever you want to say?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, JP, for having me on your show. This is, an amazing opportunity, and I'm a fan of your work. I've listened to a number of your shows, and I enjoy your interview, skills, and you're a great host. And so I appreciate taking the time to talk to me and getting me to, put my voice out there. My belief, I don't know, some people may call me, my ex-wife says I'm incorrigibly optimistic when it comes to people, give people the benefit of the doubt. But I truly believe that in spite of what we're being told in the media, in spite of what we're shown over and over and over again, that somehow we're a worthless people and worthy to be damned and destroyed because we're destroying our environment. We're horrible to each other. The greater truth is the truth that is not being revealed, that we are in fact given opportunity after opportunity, good people with beautiful hearts that really want to experience and give love in as many ways as possible. And if not for trauma and for a concerted effort to generate a certain level of negativity within us, I believe that, you know, we as a people are far more angelic and divine than we are, some would say, negative and evil. And I just encourage people to don't lose faith in humanity, because that's a part of the struggle. That's what the negative elite wants you to believe. They want you to believe that humanity is not worth saving, thereby giving up on all of us. And I say, don't give up. Believe, have faith in humanity. You know, I'm on Facebook and I constantly post different examples of people doing great things. And it doesn't take much to look around, but you won't find it in mass media, at least hardly so. But, you know, look around with your fellow human beings and believe in the heart of humanity. You know, we are descended from the gods. And there's a reason. There's a reason for that. We are truly divine at heart. So give love a chance. One love. You know, in the inimitable words of Robert Nesta Marley, which is from my homeland. You know, one love. One heart. That's my belief. That's what I'd like to say.
And with that, Michael Graham, thank you very much and good night.
Good night.
This has been Ever Beyond. Beyond.